Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Leo Laporte, because that's me. This is Triangulation, episode 100, recorded April 24th, 2013. Mitch Kapor. Welcome to Triangulation, the show where I get to interview some of the most interesting people in technology. Episode 100, that means we have 99 great interviews, but I'm so glad to have this fella for our 100th. Mitch Kapor is here, and it's a name that anybody who follows technology knows. Mitch, of course, is the founder and designer of Lotus 123, the spreadsheet, the first spreadsheet on the PC that changed everything for IBM. He then went on to found the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Served on the Mozilla board, become an open source advocate, is an inspiration for us all. It's great to talk to you, Mitch. Thanks for joining us on Triangle.
Nice to be here.
We have something in common. You were music director and program director at WYBC in New Haven.
That is so true.
So was I.
Amazingly enough.
Unfortunately, I stayed in broadcasting. I was right after you, class of 77, shortly after you. But YBC, which was Yale's radio station, but it's kind of not also. It's kind of independently run. Had no sense of history, so there was no way I would have known who my predecessors were. Did you want to be a DJ? I guess you worked in rock radio for a while.
I did. Well, it was the 60s. I had no musical talent of my own. So playing records was the closest thing I could get to in rock and roll. And it was just fabulous. And I did it in college and then professionally at WHCN in Hartford for a couple of years. It was really great. Great thing to do back then. Absolutely.
If the Wikipedia article is right, and that's what I'm cribbing this from, you kind of drifted around with different things for a while.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I was a teacher of transcendental meditation. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology. I worked in the psychiatric unit of a community hospital until I figured out how I could make a great contribution to human services, which was by getting out of it.
But you had studied. Was,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that was the summer that I bought my Apple II computer, actually. I was unemployed. I took my meager savings and I plunked it down on this machine I was completely fascinated with. And that actually changed my life dramatically.
Oh, well, you weren't alone in that. In the when it went from, and of course, when you were in college, as when I was in college, computing was a very different experience. It was you had to go down to the computer center. You had to use it in the middle of the night because everybody was using it in the daytime, and you know it was punch cards. It was a very different experience.
Yeah,
having a personal computer with a keyboard and display on your desk, people don't realize now what a revolution that was.
That's right. No, it has been forgotten. It's sort of like cars for people who grew up with horses. Cars were like a miracle. Now you can't imagine a world without cars, and it just seems pointless to talk about what a big deal it was when cars happened. But computers were like that, changed people's lives.
Yeah. So I understand anyway how getting that Apple II completely changed your focus in your life.
Totally.
Did you say I want to write software? Is that what you thought? What did you think?
Well, I had a bunch of computer experience on mainframes, and I knew a little bit of programming, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with the Apple II, but the day after I bought it, and this is a true story, I was hanging out in a computer store in Cambridge, Mass. I was unemployed. I had a lot of free time. I saw this guy buying an Apple II, well-dressed guy in a suit. I was eavesdropping on his conversation. And I walked up to him and I said, I'm a consultant and I think I can help you with your problem. I really don't usually have that kind of chutzpah, but I was inspired. And I had my Apple II 24 hours longer than he had. So I figured as long as I could stay ahead of him, he wouldn't be any wiser. And that was, it's a true story. That is how I got started in computers.
I love it. I love it. You learned the magic word, consultant.
I did. And he was paying me, I think, $7 an hour, which wow. even in 1978 was not a lot of money.
How did,
but it was enough to get started.
How did Lotus come about?
Well, after I got this first consulting gig in 78 on the Apple II, I had this, and I was in my late 20s, incredibly intensive three-year stint of consulting and starting my first software company and writing my first big program and going out to Silicon Valley for 6 months and working for a startup. And it was all a fabulous education. And out of that really came the idea for doing Lotus.
What was that? What was that first company, that first product?
So the first product was the first graphics and statistics package written, as far as I know, for the Apple II. And it was called Tiny Troll, T-R-O-L-L, because there was this statistics time-sharing program at MIT called Troll. And so this was an infinitely small subset, but it did multiple regressions, and there was a small but real paying market for it. We charged people $100 for it and duplicated the disks ourselves as me and one partner, and it was a start.
Was it written in an Apple BASIC or?
Yeah, it was written in BASIC because that's what there was. Well, that's all what I knew how to program it.
Right,
that's
right.
Well, it was that or assembly language, and that was not in my skill set to do a big program in assembly.
Right.
6502 or something.
Yeah. So, first assembly language I learned, 6502.
Yeah. So
not a sophisticated processor. In fact, I don't think it was designed to be a computer processor initially.
Well, it was an 8-bit, microcontroller that Steve Wozniak picked because it was inexpensive.
It was cheap.
Yeah. So that was the basis of
that's
the Apple.
That's how it happens. So when the IBM PC did Lotus predate the PC's release or?
No. No, in fact, the other way around, that we were working on what we wanted to do, and IBM announced the IBM PC, and I said, this is the platform
right.
to put it on, because it has IBM in the name, and it was a 16-bit processor. That was a big deal, because VisiCalc, which was an act of genius by Dan Berkman, the first spreadsheet, it was incredibly brilliant, but it was also limited to tiny spreadsheets because of the memory on the Apple II, which was 64 kilobytes. And, there was a version of VisiCalc for the IBM PC from day one, but it inherited the architectural limitations. It did take advantage of the
right.
memory.
I remember when the first VisiCalc came out on the PC.
So,
and you could download VisiCalc today, and it's like 32K. It's tiny.
Yeah, it's tiny.
We've had, by the way, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston have both been on this show. So this is perfect. We're moving through history in the right chronological order.
Well, and it started a revolution.
Oh, yeah. It was the first killer app. It was something that a killer app is an application so good you bought a computer to run it.
Sure.
And the second killer app was Lotus 1-2-3.
And so we were terribly frightened of VisiCalc. I mean, it was the 500-pound gorilla. 300,000 units had been sold at the time we came into the market.
Wow.
And what I didn't understand was how big the potential market for productivity tools was. Tens of millions of units. And Lotus just tapped into that with a product that was just optimized for the IBM PC. And so, our first year we did $50 million in sales. And
wait a minute. Brand new company, first year, $50 million in sales.
Yes, 1983, 30 years ago.
The PC was 2 years old.
That's right. So it caused the PC industry to take off in business, that product.
That's the killer app. That's right. And businesses who were wondering, well, does a personal computer have anything to do in our business, said, wait a minute, Lotus 1-2-3, look at what we can do. We could do projections. We could do spreadsheets. Were you how? But you were obviously influenced fairly heavily by VisiCalc, right? I mean, were you trying to make a VisiCalc clone?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
I thought VisiCalc was brilliant. I had a set of ideas about what should come next, and originally I went to the VisiCalc guys to try to work with them on that, and that they weren't interested. So John Sachs and I did it ourselves, but we said we need to add graphing to it. So one button, make a graph out of it.
Oh, that's right. What a revolution that was.
Yeah. We need to take full advantage of the memory space, the 640K. So big spreadsheets, which you couldn't do with VisiCalc. We had a much friendlier user interface. VisiCalc interface was kind of cryptic. It used single letter commands.
Slash key.
We had full menus and long prompts in the menus and a help system and a tutorial. And really the killer feature was the macros that we let people who were non-programmers write code to automate repetitive things in the spreadsheet. And so it just went a full generation past anything that had been there.
Did Sachs do most of the coding and you did the design? How did that work?
He did all the coding and the technical architecture. Mm-hmm. In modern day parlance, though, I was the product manager and the UX designer.
And a nice job, too. The user interface on Lotus 1-2-3. I think there's a lot of people like me that still have the keystrokes in our built into our
muscle memory. Yeah.
Muscle memory, exactly. There's the launch screen for Lotus 1-2-3. Yep. Isn't that great? Somebody posted that in our chat room.
Okay.
People remember it with great fondness, you know. And, you know, you think about what you innovated. Microsoft Excel really just took that and moved it into a GUI. What did you think about the move to Windows and the move to a GUI? I know Lotus briefly flirted with that.
So I was a bystander because I left Lotus in 87. I'm a serial entrepreneur, so I didn't have a hand in what happened, but Lotus made the wrong bet. It bet on IBM's OS2, not on Windows. It was the wrong bet to make. I can understand why, because it was helping its arch rival Microsoft. Of course, Microsoft knew that. But
right.
By not having a viable product in the Windows space, it just let Microsoft come in with Excel. They had essentially no competition.
In hindsight, of course, that was a mistake. But from a technical point of view, I think it made a lot of sense to go with OS 2. Who knew that that wasn't going to become a dominant operating system?
Yeah, I was betting, as much as I hated it, I would have bet on Windows because IBM really didn't have the business savvy to go
right.
make OS to work in the broad marketplace. That wasn't their core competency. They were good with big enterprise customers,
right.
but not the consumer market.
And well, you're right on that.
Microsoft was clearly the company that Destiny was going to favor and did.
So wrapping up, Lotus 1-2-3 gave you the opportunity to get some time, an opportunity to do some other things. In 1990, just a couple of years later, you, John Perry Barlow, and John Gilmore started the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah, that was little did we know.
Brilliant, huh?
Well, look, I've always been early on things. It's my only skill is spotting important trends early.
Not a bad single skill to have, Mitch.
I'm not complaining.
If you're going to pick one, it's better than turning bunnies into snakes or something. I mean,
that's right. But 1990 was pre-commercial internet.
Right.
Certainly pre-browser, pre-web.
Right.
The internet, the government was just starting to think about loosening access to let other people onto it besides researchers.
Because it was NSF owned it, the backbones, National Science Foundation.
Right. And so you could kind of get on. There was this community bulletin board called The Well
San
Francisco
yep.
that I was a member of and met lots of interesting people.
It's probably how you met John, right? John Gilmore.
It is how I met John.
Yeah.
Both Johns.
I remember they were both very active on The Well. Yeah.
Yeah. And there were kids who were hacking into networks, even then, what few there were.
The well was my first experience of the internet because it's a message board and it's not the internet, it's closed space. But you could drop out of the well UI to a command line. Intentionally, they set that up.
Yeah.
And from there, you could launch Archie or Gopher and you could suddenly you're on the internet. And I remember even then, even in the very early 90s, this sense of, my God, the world, the globe just opened up.
Was
palpable, but there was. But we're not talking browsers here. This was geeks.
FTP, file transfer protocol, and other protocols long since forgotten. But yeah. you could reach out and get information and talk to other people.
It's funny how much the well comes up in these conversations.
Well, it was seminal, and it was mind blowing. It was an LSD kind of experience to be in a virtual community. It felt real.
Yeah,
but you are not physically proximate. And that had never happened in history.
It was, I think, started by Stuart Brand, who had done the Whole Earth catalog. And it was stood for the Whole Earth Electronic Link, something like that?
Yes, exactly.
And it was, anybody who's used a message board system today is familiar with it in its fundamental shape. But it was just text-oriented. People tended to have very short three- or four-letter I think with three-letter handles in many cases.
Yeah.
And the flame, initially it felt like a garden. It was famous, though, for some of its flame wars.
It had all of the dynamics that we now have writ large on the internet.
Yeah.
There can be incredibly engaging conversations and then horrible interchanges,
yeah.
You know, randomly interspersed. Sort of, that's Reddit. I mean, Reddit is
Reddit.
Well,
yeah.
Only a billion times larger.
Yeah.
So you're asking about EFF. One of the topics of discussion on EFF was the fact that Secret Service and other agencies were busting hackers and locking them up and throwing away the key.
Wow.
And this seems wrong in the sense of being incredibly disproportionate, because at that time you didn't have criminal syndicates, and these were kids who were basically trespassing and maybe spray painting some graffiti digitally, but really, really not worse than that, and were facing felony charges and long prison sentences. And we saw this as a civil liberties issue, and it was just out of ignorance. All this was new. All this computer networking was new, and law enforcement was not familiar with it and was making mistakes. And we started EFF to make the case that civil liberties protected under the Bill of Rights extended into cyberspace. I mean, as long as you're doing it from the U.S. And we were actually very successful initially in raising consciousness and in getting issues reframed and in really establishing basic protections. And you know, EFF has gone on and now plays a very important role in a very different ecosystem that's big, and the world's economy depends on.
And ironically, we're still fighting that battle of hackers being treated as massive criminals. And you look at somebody like Aaron Schwartz, it's still happening.
It is still happening. What I would also say, though, is that the bad guys have long since discovered the internet, are on it, are using it. Every bad thing that individuals and groups of people do, they now do in and on and through and with the internet.
Oh, yeah.
And so there are very significant policy issues about what we do about all that without becoming totalitarian. So actually, I'm a sympathetic to and an advisor to EFF and continue to support it, I find myself sometimes much more divided and torn. I'm not a pure play civil libertarian, because I understand the needs of governments to help maintain order.
Well,
and it's a mess.
It is
a mess.
That's how it is. It's anarchic. It's the nature of the internet.
Yeah, I just have a different perspective 20 years later.
Well, and John Perry Barlow has talked a little bit about kind of this tension in, even on the board of EFF between people who say no government intervention at all and those who say there's a place for the government. It's a very difficult problem.
It is a hard problem. It's sort of the genie is out of the bottle and it's not going to go back in.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the internet's current architecture and the practices are responsible for lots of problems we don't have or amplifying lots of problems. It's people who cause the problems.
Of course.
Like guns don't kill people.
Right.
But I'm an advocate of gun control and I'm an advocate of having some rational and pragmatic ways of addressing the problems of bad things that happen in internet networks.
The other thing that is a thread throughout your life now is open source software, or very early on, a big supporter of open source software.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because you made your big hit with a closed source program.
Yeah. Well, that's what there was at the time.
Right.
I have to say that my first experience with open source was post-Lotus. Well, it was still there, but we were already had our own building and we were quite successful. And we were picketed by Richard Stallman. and it was,
free,
it was my
free, yeah, software,
free software foundation,
foundation yeah.
and really the father of
GNU and,
the father of open source.
Well, he wrote Emacs. Yeah, and then really is the father of open source. Do you think had there been open source, though, that you would have said Lotus 1-2-3 should be an open source project?
Probably not.
No.
But if I'd grown up in a culture where open source was important, an important part of the ecosystem, I think my business would have supported and reflected it.
Yes.
Say, more like Google. The Google guys,
right,
unlike Bill Gates, came of age when there was already an internet. And they understand, they would never, for instance, want to do something to sort of close or control the internet. I mean, they wouldn't have a business.
Right.
Whereas Microsoft, coming a decade, two decades earlier, before there was an internet, actually tried to do a set of proprietary protocols for wide area communication. I mean, that lost terribly to
Bob,
the internet.
Bob Frankston was there and kind of undermined the whole thing.
Yeah. But I think it's progress actually consists of the fact, in part, that things like open source find their way into the world and become part of the environment. The internet is built on it, and the commercial world learns to coexist with it in, interesting and useful and healthy kinds of ways.
You know, that's really interesting. I never thought about it. And part of it's because this is moving so much faster than the normal course of human events. But a business model designed 10 years ago doesn't make sense in the modern world of the internet. You really have to shift your whole – a company like Google now is even starting to look old school compared to maybe what's going to happen in the next few years.
That's right. So that's why there's a place for venture capital and angel investors, because the whole software stack in every market gets completely redone, every, decade.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Just keeps going. And now everything is being redone for mobile and cloud.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
So you say your skill is being able to see ahead. And when I look at your CV, it's obvious you're very, very good at that. In 2003, you were first chair of the Mozilla Foundation. When Netscape bought the code, they open sourced it. They gave it away. And for many years, Mozilla was often seen as a failed example of open source.
Well, it was a failed example, and then it became a successful example.
It was failed until it made it.
Well, because Firefox was an offshooter, was a,
that's right,
a side project that was not well regarded inside Mozilla.
Isn't that interesting?
Until it took over the world, in which case everybody said, "Oh yeah, no, we liked this all along."
Yeah, so people forget Mozilla was a suite. I mean, it had a whole bunch. There was Composer, and there was all this stuff, Thunderbird,
right,
all this stuff.
Which is not what people wanted. They wanted just a browser. Thank you. yeah. that was not Internet Explorer.
Right.
That was the other thing, that at the point where Firefox took off, it was sort of the trough of Internet Explorer. It didn't work well. It was buggy. It was
right.
slow. It had all. It was insecure, and so Microsoft was not investing in it. So there was really an opportunity. I mean, having vanquished Netscape, saw no need to continue right. to innovate in the browsing space. So.
And that happened in 1996. Does it feel like a whirlwind? I mean, do you feel like this stuff is going boom, 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 boom? Or do you see it a kind of logical, steady path?
Oh, no. I think it's kind of punctuated equilibrium where
yeah.
there are
yeah, yeah.
Immense disruptions that happen in short periods of time, and then things settle down until the next set of disruptions. But what I will say is what we've been talking about is really ancient history to people in their 20s who are building the next generation of things.
Oh, I know. I have to explain this so that they can understand what this means. But it's not ancient history. It's a couple of decades ago. A decade
That's
ago.
Right. And it's also the hidden advantage, competitive advantage for people who live through it. We're not as smart as or as fast as
those youngsters.
Digital natives. it's just, you know, you get old, you lose your moves. But on the other hand,
we're the wily yeah. veterans.
Satchel Paige.
right.
Of tech. And I, you know, so when Facebook announced this platform a few years ago, and it was such a big deal and everybody was so enthusiastic about it. I was very cautious because I lived through what Microsoft did with its platform, which is they kind of did a lot in the early years to get people to build on top of it. And then they did things in the later years to really control it and shut people out to move in their own apps. And I think it's sort of a logic of how you build yeah. dominant platforms. You don't have to be evil to do that. It's just sort of the way it works. And I was talking about that, and people thought the 20-somethings, this is in 2008, thought I was like, they found it incomprehensible until like, you know, the last year. And I get emails from people. I said, you gave this talk. I found it. How did you know? And I explained to them, well, it's sort of like the movie Psycho. You know, first Hitchcock made it in the 60s, but much more recently it was remade shot for shot by Gus Van Sant. And if you went in and you saw the new Psycho and you didn't know it had ever been made before, and you're sitting next to me, I'm saying, no, that lady, she should not go in the shower. Something really bad is good. Don't go in the shower. And, you know, and she gets all hacked up and stabbed in the shower. And my seatmate says, how did you know that? And I said, well, I've seen the movie.
We've seen this movie before.
Yeah. So,
But you're not, okay. You're not, okay, I'm going to find a flaw, Mitch, because you...
Let's talk about my flaws.
Your flaws. Linden Labs. Now, maybe you don't consider that a flaw, but you were one of the founders of and served on the board, chairman of the board, Second Life.
Yes.
Now, I can't blame you because everybody, myself included, thought that these virtual worlds were the next big thing.
Yeah. Well, so it's been a partial success. So first of all, one thing people don't know is that Second Life is still going. It's like a $70, $80 million a year business. The user-to-user economy is still $500 million a year. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of daily users. It's not like it's gone away. But what it has done is that the growth has absolutely flattened out. And it isn't really in and of itself going anywhere. It sort of reached the limits of what it could do with that user interface and that technology stack, and it's going to be stuck there. But I think virtual worlds will come back in a new
Absolutely.
Incarnation. It may be Linden, it may not be Linden.
Right.
And so, you know, it's one of these, it's kind of like DOS without the Windows, you know?
Right.
DOS was a very big deal as an operating system.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't going to take over the whole world. It was too hard, too cryptic, too limited. It needed a graphical user interface. It needed Windows and the Mac. And we don't have that yet for virtual worlds. Linden Labs, Second Life, is the DOS of virtual worlds.
Right.
And it's actually
not the DOS. It's more like the Windows 3.0 because there have been, I can remember, avatar-based chats. There have been all sorts of attempts at this. Ever since Neil Stephenson wrote Snow Crash and talked about the metaverse, people have wanted to go into a virtual world.
Right. Well, we should argue that I would say those things are sort of the CPMs.
Okay.
Obscure historical.
Good enough.
Reference.
Good enough.
And the people, the Second Life residents, hate me whenever I say anything because it's always the wrong thing because they think I'm making fun or limiting them, and I'm just designed to them.
No, but any technology that has its adherence, if you say anything that isn't negative about the technology, but just say, hey, look, it's not going to be the next big thing, they feel betrayed. But as you said, we've seen this movie before. I think about Microsoft loving tablets for 10 years with no success at all, and all of a sudden Apple comes along and tablets are the next big thing. And sure. I'm completely convinced with you that at some point, and I hope it's before my end times, we will be able to enter virtual worlds and we'll feel immersed in them and be able to interact with them in the same way that we do the real world.
Well, you know, Philip Rosedale, who started Second Life, has a new company called High Fidelity that's still fairly stealthy, but they've said that they're working on next generation virtual reality. Mm. So,
well, with the Oculus Rift, you got the technology's catching up.
Yeah, so I think we'll see interesting things. So Linden is not, in terms of next big thing, isn't huge, but it's also not dead. I thought you were going to mention Chandler.
That's next. And, you know, Chandler is a really interesting story that no one knows. But
good.
But I was very excited. This was an open source project to create... Yes. At the time, PIMs were big, personal information managers. We don't even use the word PIM anymore. But
I was trying to be a replacement for Outlook and Exchange, but also have the spirit of Lotus Agenda, which is this product they did 20 years ago. That was a free-form information manager that had a small but very dedicated cult following that really let you organize the contents of your brain.
And I remember reading that Mitch Kapor was working on the ultimate open source PIM. Yeah. At the time, Linux didn't really have a very good Outlook replacement. And I was so excited. I know the whole world was, the whole Linux using world was. What happened?
It was too ambitious. It was sort of a victim of over ambition and me not having a sense of my own limits, but having the ability to write checks to support the thing for quite a long time. So one of the dangers of self-funded projects is they lack kinds of checks and balances to say, hey, this really isn't working and we're not going to keep supporting it. So well-intentioned, great people. The only actual thing of value that came out of it is CalDAV, which is the exchange protocol that's used to share and synchronize calendars. That was part of
CalDAV is critical to Google calendars. Apple uses it, although Microsoft and Google are fighting over it. I guess Google's abandoning it, which is a shame.
It was very much not a lean startup. What we were trying to do, too many people trying to do too much. And it was also, for people who are interested in it, there's quite a good book documenting it that's written sympathetically but critically called Dreaming in Code by Scott Rosenberg.
Wonderful.
We had an embedded journalist. It was so educational for me because since then, in all the projects I backed as a seed stage tech investor and now an impact investor, the focus on taking things in small steps and really adhering to the core spirit of lean startup, of minimal viable product and things like that. I've really taken that to heart and it's worked incredibly well. I'm a true believer in it. And if I hadn't gone through the pain of Chandler not working, I don't think I would have taken the lessons to heart as much.
Well, in fact, every entrepreneur I talk to has a Chandler.
Somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there. But you need to learn that. In fact, Scott's subtitle for the book, Dreaming in Code, kind of says it all. Two dozen programmers, 3 years, 4,732 bugs, and one quest for transcendent software.
Yeah.
And the only reason I remember Chandler is because I was disappointed. I was really looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, we disappointed a lot of people, which is another important lesson. It's kind of be careful about that kind of stuff.
Well, I don't want to make you feel bad.
No, I don't. It's actually... As I said, educational in the best sense that, while very, very painful, I think I and others came out of it really having learned some pretty deep lessons.
Yeah. You say you're an impact investor. What is that?
Well, so it's the idea of investments having a double bottom line, that they should simultaneously create both economic value but also social value. So, for instance, in education, to be ed tech, to be very concrete, we look at closing gaps in access and achievement. Like if there's some math supplemental, online curriculum, we say, is this being done in a way that if the company succeeds, it's actually going to close the achievement gap between the low-income and higher-income populations? Because we think that's a good thing to do. We think technology can help, and that would be an impact, a positive social impact investment to do that. So we look.
Tell me about some of your impact investments.
Okay. So a bunch of things in education. One that we've done.
Boy, education's begging to be reinvented, isn't it?
Well, education and healthcare are areas that, our society is dependent on. They've been, relatively speaking, underinvested in terms of really good tech, information technology. So one instance is a company called Asthmopolis. And they make a little wireless sensor that sits on top of an emergency asthma inhaler. So if you use your emergency inhaler and you're asthmatic, you're trying to stave off an attack. And it sends, every time you use one of these gizmos, it sends a little message up into the cloud. It can alert your healthcare provider. It can send you a reminder to take your medication. It's pretty simple tech, but what they found is, is that it actually reduces trips to the emergency room and rehospitalization, just because there's more awareness and you can cut off somebody going out of control, stop yourself from going out of control before you wind up in the ER, and that's very expensive and bad for your health. So it actually produces better health outcomes and reduces healthcare costs. So that's an impact investment in the health space.
This is cool. So it's both, it's a hardware device that goes on the inhaler, but then there's an iPhone app and there's a web page.
There's a whole set of stuff, and it goes out through, healthcare systems provide it for free to their clients because it actually saves the healthcare system money. So, and there are, quite a few opportunities like that. We're looking in education at something in bilingual education for English language learners, where the government allocates a lot of money already to some dedicated funds. But there isn't an online curriculum that is both pedagogically terrific and culturally highly relevant. No one had just gone and made it. We found these wonderful Latina entrepreneurs who had done this, and we're backing them. And it's in pilot now. But really, in terms of helping kids who come to the country who don't speak English really learn English and be in the mainstream in schools and therefore have an opportunity to make something of their lives and not be marginalized. Boy, that's a great thing to do. So
it must be fun. You must be enjoying it.
Yeah.
It sounds like fun.
It is fun and it feels meaningful. And we see a lot of entrepreneurs who have been successful in tech. When they do their second startup, they say, I did this advertising network, nothing wrong with that, but I don't want to do that. I want to do something that makes a difference. I want to help deliver, do something. I want to do WebVan, but without losing $1 billion building. Yeah. There's an interesting company called Good Eggs, started by ex-Google guys, that is working on local healthy foods, both raw food and prepared food, that can be delivered same day to you, but doing it with like Uber-style logistics, meaning don't spend $1 billion on some plant, do it without actually having to, you know, invest in... do it in a way that the economics work, which they never did for WebVan. And I think that's super smart. And they're very committed. Every time they go into a high-income community neighborhood, you know, like Pacific Heights in San Francisco, where I used to live before I moved to Oakland, they also set it up so that it is serving, you know, a lower-income community on the other side of the bay. Because they want the benefits of the tech to be broadly distributed. So that's, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you one other impact. You know, we consider to be an impact investment is Uber itself.
Love Uber.
Uber is a job creation machine because it takes drivers, and these are typically all immigrants, who have been working hourly for somebody else, and it lets them operate their own independent business by being an Uber driver. And if they have initiative and work hard, I mean, it's created many thousands of jobs already, and job creation, it's super important.
But you talk to the taxi commissions in many cities, including D.C. and Toronto, and all, they are not happy about Uber because they feel like they've got a medallion system, and you guys are completely bypassing this entrenched bureaucratic system they've got.
I think the battle is over there, though, because
it is. Didn't you want a big victory recently?
And yeah, in East Coast cities, in D.C. and Boston, and this is the way the world is going now. And so the taxi commissions are fighting a rear guard action that isn't. I mean, there's a lot of mopping up to do, but there's only one outcome here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you know. It's better. It's more convenient. It's safer.
I love it. We took Uber in Paris for the first time at Le Web last year when you launched in Paris, and it was wonderful.
It's great. And there are now multiple classes of services. So it just started out as car service, but now there's, you know, a taxi level, and the company has actually said it's going to go into the rideshare market also in those cities where. Where the regulators have said ride sharing is okay.
Yeah, Avis just bought Zapcar, right? So, CityShare, one of those.
Yeah, there's been consolidation already in that. I mean, urban transportation is, well.
That's another one ripe for reinvention.
Yes, well, driverless cars. And who would have thought? Because a bunch of experts have said, you know, 15 years ago, there'll never be driverless cars. It's too hard a problem, technically.
They were solving the wrong problem. They thought they had to build new roads.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This is, like, amazing. All right, lots of credit to Google on pushing all this.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Yeah, these cars are remarkable. All right, so we got a few minutes left. What do you think going forward, if you had some money to impact invest or even not impact invest? What I mean, obviously mobile is happening, but what else? What exciting trends do you see out there?
Well, here's a trend that I see. Chess. Not that chess is the trend, but chess playing. The best chess player in the world is not a machine, and it's not a person. It's a team of people and machines. And the people by themselves aren't grandmasters, and the machines by themselves aren't the best standalone chess players. But it's the hybrid. And I think these hybrid systems that take the best of what computers could do and use the best of human creativity, intelligence, and judgment, that's going to be a very big deal, particularly in education, but I also think in healthcare and in other areas.
So it's not that we're getting better chess players, but what you're saying is this human-machine mix where you have the intuitive, synthetic abilities of a human combined with the vast speed and databases of a machine can create something new.
And better than what you could do with either one alone. So I think that's going to be a trend in systems that do that well. And I think we're going to see some in education. They're going to use the computers to do routine, patient, step-by-step online instruction with students.
Right.
But use teachers, pull the teachers in as coaches to help get kids really unstuck and to do the kinds of things that you really want to do with people in a, you know, face-to-face kind of way. Leveraging the precious resources.
Clearly, we have to reinvent education, and a lot of attention is paid on to higher education because,
yeah.
as everybody talks about now, it's so expensive and there's such a burden of debt. There's really no financial justification for going to college. But of course, where you're going to make the greatest difference is in lower education.
You bet. Well, I'm probably even in preschool.
Preschool.
You
know? Wow.
Well, the earlier, and it's a complicated issue: how to use tech. Every time I see an 18-month-old in front of an iPad, I shudder slightly.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But the earlier you can intervene,
right,
the more powerful the effect is going to be. And certainly K-12, everybody agrees that the model of classrooms that we have today, which is inherited from the late 19th century, is obsolete, but we don't exactly know what is going to replace it.
Right, right. And we've seen some spectacular failures, like Chris Whittle's attempt to create for-profit public education.
That's right. In for-profit K-12, probably not a great idea.
No.
But charter schools, on the other hand, which were very unpopular with progressives when they first came out, have really demonstrated that innovation can happen if you're willing to let little experiments,
yes.
standalone experiments, flourish. And if you don't permit that to happen, you don't get the innovation. Now the problem is, okay, successful innovations in a variety of different charter schools, how do you get scale? Big problem. How do you import those changes back so that an entire urban public school system benefits across the board? That's a systems change problem, hard problem. People are working on it.
Mitch, it's so great that you are in this world. I don't know how to put it any other way.
Oh, you're too kind.
But you've made such a huge contribution in so many areas, and you continue to. And, you know, I've just touched on a few of them, and I think anybody watching goes, wow, oh, he did that. Oh, wow, he did that. Oh, he did that. I mean, it's just, it's really exciting. And I'm glad to see also that people like us in our later years, over 50, card-holding members of the AARP have something to contribute to this revolution.
Yeah, no, we're not. We're not completely obsolete yet by any means.
We've seen this movie, and we can tell you the plot.
Right. Don't go in the shower.
Do not go in the shower. Been there, done that. Do not go into the shower, Mitch. It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. I know you have a place up in the north there, and it's right off 101 on the way. If you ever want to stop at the Twit Brick House, we'd love to have you in studio.
We go right past where you are, and so all right, we'll make it.
We'll do it on a weekend when it's on your way.
Consider it done.
Thank you, Mitch Kapor, everybody.
All right.
Thank you. What a great way to celebrate our 100th episode. Thank you, Mitch. Take care. And if you want to know more, of course, I think it's pretty easy to find Mitch Kapor's website. And, there's a lot more to know about Mitch. Just a fascinating guy. We do this show every Wednesday. And each and every time, I'm just blown away by the quality of guests. And kudos to Karsten Bondi, who's been producing the show for the last few months and has got some great guests. We did have next week. We had a reschedule. Doug Rushkoff was going to be on. I'm very excited about talking to Doug. But, so it's a mystery next week. But we have some wonderful people on the agenda going forward. These are, I think, you know, in some ways, what I think we're doing is making historical records of the people who are really thinking and changing the world. And I'm so glad that you could join us. If you'd like to come back every Wednesday, about 4 o'clock Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time, that's 2400, right at midnight UTC. Or if you can't watch live, and I do appreciate it when you do because I love the chat room and the feedback you give me and the suggestions for questions. You can always watch after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video available at twit.tv/TRI. Or you can get it each and every week automatically if you just subscribe on one of the podcatchers, the podcast aggregators like iTunes. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.